Good afternoon and welcome to CSIS. Our guest this afternoon is Guy Caruso. He's the administrator of the Energy Information Administration, EIA, and he's here to unveil the agency's 2007 International Energy Outlook. His remarks are on the record, and we expect to be able to post his presentation on our website either later today or first thing tomorrow. With the heightened attention paid to energy supply and prices today, the projections for increased demand and the projected role for coal, biofuels, and nuclear, and the implications of various fuel choices on greenhouse gases and climate change, it's not any wonder why this room is full this afternoon. As many of you know, CSIS is involved in the National Petroleum Council's study on global energy. And one of the things we did was we looked at forecasts by a number of different institutions, both public and private, governmental as well. And when I look at the work that's been done at EIA, certainly for the United States, the data and analysis that goes into this is superior to almost anything in the world. There's very few forecasts that have integrated supply and demand and cover them in the level of detail. And a lot of that is due, some of it's institutional, but a lot is due to Guy Caruso's leadership. I've known Guy for almost 30 years now, and we are just children at the Department of Energy. In that period, I found that he's both thoughtful, calming, and comprehensive as an approach to energy. He has an intimate familiarity with energy markets. He's worked at the IEA, the EIA, at the CIA. There's a pattern going on here. But he's the right person at the right time for this job because there's a lot of misinformation out there, and the need for data and analysis of what's going on in the market is just key for planning and for policymakers. So with that, let me introduce to you Guy Caruso, and we'll run through the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's a great pleasure to be here again, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As Frank has mentioned, I had spent some time here at CSIS. Doesn't seem to fit the pattern of the three-letter acronyms at EIA, CIA, and IEA, but it's certainly a lot better than some of the four-letter words I hear when the gasoline prices come out every Monday, you know. But also thank your team here, Frank, Jennifer, and Bob, and now Dave Pumphrey. Really a great team you've put together, and I look forward to continue to work with the energy program here at CSIS. And I'll be presenting, as Frank mentioned, our latest International Energy Outlook, the IEO, which we do about this time every year. This year's projections go out to 2030. It's an extension to what we do in the domestic outlook, which is the annual energy outlook, published now several months ago. So it's completely consistent with respect to assumptions on GDP growth and oil prices, those that are critical to the outcome of the analysis. And I want to pay a special thanks to Glenn Sweetnam, who heads up the team in the EIA that does all the work to do the International Energy Outlook, and Linda Dolman, who coordinates this project. Thank you very much, Glenn, Linda, and the team that's behind you to do this work. And as Frank pointed out, as participants in the National Petroleum Council study that is currently underway, it's been very instructive to see work that's being done around the world on this type of analysis. And I, again, very appreciative of all the work of the team in EIA to put this together. Critically important, as always, are the assumptions that are behind this. Include, I mentioned oil prices, which we'll talk about. The largest single driver in this outlook is the macroeconomic assumptions, the GDP assumptions for countries around the world, and we'll get into a little bit more detail on those, and population growth, of course, as well. The other thing that's really very important to remember is that this is a long-term outlook based on policies and programs that are currently in place and on track as of January 2007. And you'll see from some of the results in here that changes in those policies, whether it have to do with environmental issues or efficiency standards that we're hearing and currently debating within the U.S. Congress, are being certainly discussed in the EU and in APEC. So clearly this is a picture that may change, but it's important to have this, we think, as a benchmark from which to think about the future. And as always, it's not so much the pinpoint numbers that will be shown here, but the trends and what the implications of those trends indicate. And some of the key highlights are shown on this first chart. We do expect that, driven by strong global economic growth, world energy demand will increase by nearly 60% over the next 25 years. And by far the largest share of that growth will be in the developing countries, particularly those in Asia. Another thing that the higher prices are making, I think, very clear as we have more time to analyze what's going on in investments, is that unconventional production of liquids certainly will increase as a result of relatively high real oil prices that we're assuming here, and that includes oil sands from Canada, which we hear a lot about, but also perhaps coal to liquids that are being discussed in many places around the globe. And gas to liquids, biofuels, again, in this country, but also in a number of other countries, such as Brazil, are going to make an increasingly important contribution. Among the fossil fuels, coal will be the fastest-growing fuel type, largely because its prices remain relatively low compared with oil and natural gas, and that the electric power sector, particularly that in China and India, will continue to increase their use of coal and will account for, along with the United States, about 86% of the projected coal demand increase. We do think the nuclear sector will benefit from higher fossil fuel prices and increased attention to greenhouse gas emissions, and we do project substantial growth in the nuclear generation of electricity over the next 25 years. And because this outlook continues to be one dominated by fossil fuels, and as I mentioned, with coal the single largest growing fuel type, this reference case shows carbon dioxide emissions growing significantly over the next 20 to 25 years, and the specific numbers are there in front of you. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. The point I made early on about developing countries being by far the largest growth in this global demand for energy is shown here, in that non-OECD or non-developed countries exceeds non-OECD demand for marketed energy, exceeds that of the OECD or industrialized countries around 2010. So we already are very close to that period where the demand for energy in the developing countries will exceed that in OECD. In terms of growth rate, for those who are interested, non-OECD growth rate in this outlook is 1.8% per year, compared with only 0.8% per year. I'm sorry. The total world is 1.8%, OECD 0.8%, and non-OECD 2.6%, so a very different picture depending on the region we're in. I'm not sure something was wrong with that. There it is. I mentioned that macroeconomic assumptions are the key drivers, and this chart does single out some individual regions and countries based on their average annual GDP growth projections as well as population growth. And you can see that China and India in particular stand out in terms of their very robust average annual GDP growth. And just for completeness, I should mention that in the, these are using GDP in purchasing power parity, on purchasing power parity basis, as defined by the IMF. But you can see why non-OECD or emerging economies are where the energy demand growth is going to be over the next 20 to 25 years. It's because that's where global economic growth is going to be. In addition, significant population growth is shown in the regions of Africa and the Middle East here, which also are an important component to the energy demand. This price outlook is very similar to what we were assuming a year ago when we published both the annual energy outlook for 2006 and the international energy outlook for 2006, and that is real oil prices in that $50 to $60 per barrel range are expected to be sustainable in this outlook, given the economic growth that I mentioned and the demand for energy that we are projecting. We recognize, as we all live through volatile energy markets, even in the last several years in particular, that there's a great uncertainty out there on energy prices, not only on a short-term basis, which we're seeing again this year, but even on a long-term basis, there's considerable uncertainty about the availability of the resources, even though we believe the resources are there in terms of ultimately recoverable resources. It's the above-the-ground risks that are going to make the difference here, and that's why we've chosen to pretty wide range for our high and low price cases, which are shown in more detail in the report. It could be as low as $36 in real terms in the low case, and up to $100 in the high case. And in nominal dollars, for example, that $100 per barrel is $157. So it's quite a substantial range, and there are detailed projections in the report that show what the impact of those two cases are, but I will be concentrating this afternoon on the reference case. What does it do for the types of fuel we are projecting that will be used around the globe over the next 20 to 25 years? Prices do matter in the long run, even though the responsiveness of price of demand to price is relatively low in the short term. Over the long term, we do see the share of oil or liquids, and when you include, in as we do, non-petroleum liquids in this outlook, the share does decline from 38% of the world's energy in 2004 to about 34% in 2030. Again, it's not the detail numbers that's as important as that the trend is that with higher oil prices, consumers at all levels in all regions will do fuel switching when it's available and appropriate. And in one example shown here, coal does increase its market share around the world from 26% to 28%. in Cole's case, of course, most of it's used for electric power generation, so there's relatively little competition between coal and liquid, but there is some in the developing countries in both the electric power and industrial sector. Natural gas grows, but at about the same rate of growth as total energy, about 1.9% per year. And you'll remember total energy was growing about 1.8% per year. And natural gas's largest growth around the world will be in electric power, for electric power generation, and in industrial sectors. And that's, again, mainly in non-OECD, Asia, and in other emerging economies. The renewables grows steadily, increases its share a bit. Hydro sources in places outside of the OECD countries still has some room to grow. Solar and wind will grow fairly rapidly. However, from such a small base, it still represents a relatively small share of the total. And nuclear, after many years of projecting that nuclear share would actually decline over this time frame, we now have it flat, and I'll show in more detail where that will be. But the nuclear component actually increases a bit compared to what we were saying a year ago. And this is shown here that a year ago we thought nuclear would be 35 quadrillion BTUs. We're increasing to 40 in this outlook. But other areas where there have been some changes, total demand is down a bit in 2030 compared to what we were saying a year ago. And that's mainly because we have slightly lower economic growth in the OECD countries and faster growth in non-OECD countries, and in the OECD countries with high energy intensity, that means that the impact on total energy demand is reasonably important and does reduce the total here by about 20 quadrillion BTUs. Other areas where there's some change worth noting is the natural gas on a compared to last year is down in with the higher prices. We have a slightly lower natural gas consumption, and that's largely in the electric power sector. And the liquids consumption by region, again, the two main areas where we see consumption of liquids growing are in North America and in the non-OECD Asia. In North America, it's up about 7 million barrels a day compared to what it was in 2004. And in non-OECD Asia, about 15 million barrels a day. So between the North American and non-OECD Asia consumption of liquids, those two together account for 22 million barrels a day out of a total world growth of 35 million barrels a day. Other areas which are show important in growth, although relatively small in total, are Central and South America and the Middle East. OECD Europe remains reasonably flat. And looking at the total, I guess there's, I mentioned that the increase from 2004 to 2030 is about 35 million barrels a day from 83 to 118. But the composition of how that's going to be supplied changes. And that is that OPEC's conventional liquids production grows steadily over this time frame, but non-OPEC conventional crude is close to flattening out there as you get toward the middle of this time frame. It goes from about 47 million barrels a day this year to 54. 53, whereas OPEC goes up by about 20 million barrels a day. But I mentioned that the higher price of oil does bring into play a significant amount of unconventional liquids production, led by oil sands of Canada, heavy oils in Venezuela, and as well as coal to liquids, gas to liquids, and increasingly important biofuels in this outlook, going from about 2.5 million barrels a day last year to over 10 in 2030. In looking at where will the non-OPEC liquids supply come from, we've shown here those regions which are expected to show significant increases. In the United States, we have some growth in deep water oil production in the next several years, and then over time, we also included in here are the unconventional liquids from biofuels and coal to liquids. So in the United States, we actually have some growth when you include these unconventional liquids in the outlook. Canada increased mainly because of the oil sands, and in the other areas, it's more conventional liquids of crude oil from Russia, the Caspian countries primarily, Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. And then in China, it's a combination of, but mostly the result of biofuels and coal to liquids, which add to the Chinese supply of liquids. In Africa, again, growth there is West African, some of the newer producers, as well as some additional sources of supply. Central and South America, outside of OPEC, is mainly the largest increase there is from Brazil, and both deep water offshore crude oil as well as biofuels. Now, as I mentioned, OPEC would be by far the largest source of the increase in that 35 million barrel a day growth in liquids consumption. This shows that OPEC, how the 20 million barrels a day we're expecting from OPEC countries over the next 20 to 25 years will be allocated in our best judgment. And, of course, the Middle East with the high reserves will account for by far the largest share of that, going from 23.5 to more than 37.5. Other increases are shown there. West Africa being largely Nigeria and now Angola, which has joined OPEC, is an important growth area, more than doubling of production from that part of Africa. Relatively flat elsewhere. Now, the unconventional liquids that I've mentioned on a regional basis, this is a quick snapshot of how that looks on a technology-by-technology basis. And by far, the bottom part of that bar chart, which is light blue, is the Canadian oil sands. That's the largest growth, going from about a little over a million barrels a day last year to about 3.5 in 2030. Then you have the ultra-heavy crudes in the Orinoco region of Venezuela. And then biofuels comes next. And indeed, this is our best judgment of where biofuels are headed, given existing economics and existing policies. Now, we hear projections and plans for much larger numbers, but this is based on the policies that were in place, as I mentioned, as of the end of last year, and on the economics that exist at that time for things like cellulose, making ethanol from cellulosic material, which continues to be more expensive than either corn-based or sugarcane-based ethanol. if either policies change or economics improves, that is one area in this unconventional liquid outlook that could change dramatically. The other one, coal to liquids, is shown here growing very sharply in the period between 2020 and 2025 and 2030. That's both in the United States and in China in this outlook, as well as some gas to liquids. Turning to natural gas, again, a similar picture, and that is that the non-OECD, in particular those countries in Asia, will grow their use of natural gas significantly in both the industrial and in the electric power sector. And again, the price of natural gas will certainly make a difference on how the consumption is allocated among both regions and among sectors. In our own case, in the United States, the higher price of natural gas does indicate to in our outlook for the U.S. that we would have a slowing down in the natural gas used in electric power sector, and that all other things being equal, that coal would gain market share in that sector in the U.S. If under the assumption that there are no carbon restrictions. So again, OECD is surpassed by non-OECD even in this sector as early as 2015. And where will that gas come from? By far the largest reserves of natural gas around the globe are in Russia, Qatar, and in Iran, and therefore you can see that the Russia and Middle East areas grow significantly here, increasing by about 20% over the 25-year time frame as a share of the of total gas supplies. We also see some growth in other non-OECD countries, such as the west coast of Africa, with LNG supplies from Nigeria and Angola increasing, as well as some Asian suppliers, such as Vietnam, as part of that picture. But the main takeaway from this chart is that it will be the supply of natural gas will be largely outside of the OECD countries, as the U.S., Canada, and European supplies are either flat or grow very slowly over this time frame. Mentioned that coal grows fastest among the fossil fuels, and this is shown very clearly here, in that it increases in particularly in the United States, China, and India, all of which are largely because of the sharp growth in the electric power sector. Those three countries, U.S., China, and India, account for about 86% of all of the growth for coal in the in this world consumption outlook. Electric power generation doubles, or about doubles, over this time frame, and again led by the developing countries in the non-OECD. Put it in perspective, in 2004, non-OECD accounted for about 25% less in electricity generation than OECD. By 2030, it will be 30% more. So it's a dramatic turnaround led by those countries with very high GDP growth rates, as I indicated in the beginning of the presentation. I mentioned that nuclear power has shown increasing potential for growth in recent years, and we now are seeing projects on the drawing boards, particularly in OECD and non-OECD Asia, and therefore you You can see in this chart that we have substantial growth in Asia in the nuclear power generating capacity, in addition to growth, for the first time, fairly significant growth in North America, partly as a result of incentives in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 in this country, and partly as continuing concerns over carbon dioxide emissions lead utilities to and governments to move in the direction of nuclear. And therefore, we do anticipate that nuclear power growth will be we have a 68% increase in nuclear power generation capacity in the non-OECD in this outlook. Renewables, as I indicated, we do see growth around the world, particularly in the non-OECD, but it remains relatively the market share of total energy about the same because of cost considerations and the lack of available hydro resources. What it means for carbon dioxide emissions is that we have a significant growth globally, but importantly, most of that would be in the non-OECD, with the OECD emissions going from about 13 billion metric tons in 2004 to about 17, but the outside of OECD, 13 in 2004, going to doubling to 26 in 2030. And that is another way of showing those same numbers by fuel. And you can see the growth in coal does make an important difference in this outlook for carbon dioxide emissions. When coal and liquids were emitting emissions from coal and liquids were about equal in 2005, and we see coal increasing and accounting for 20% more of the emissions than liquids by 2030. So let me conclude by where I began. That is that very strong global economic growth will lead to continued steady demand for energy consumption in the world over the next 25 years, based on this reference case. We do think unconventional liquids will increase as a result of the higher price of oil, and that with natural gas prices relatively high compared with coal will increase as its share of total world energy, assuming that there are no carbon restrictions, and that developing country use of energy will exceed that of those of the industrialized countries by 2010 and will substantially exceed them by 2030. China being a leading consumer of energy and will be actually higher in use of energy than the United States by 2030. What this means for carbon dioxide emissions is that we will see a significant increase in carbon dioxide emissions under existing policies and under these current assumptions. So all of the of what I've presented today will be on our website as early as this afternoon, as well as additional special analyses that EIA does. And with that, Frank, and ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Guy. One of the notions that we've been playing around here with at CSIS is when you look at global demand, clearly it's from the emerging and developing economies, so non-OECD. but increasingly the resource holders are also non-OECDs. So this concept of a changing map with changing rules is something we all need to be cognizant of. Questions. Two simple questions or two simple rules here for questions at CSIS. Identify yourself and please ask your question in the form of a question. So it's good. We'll start right in the middle in the back here. Go ahead.
Got the right mic. Hi, Dan Raviv of CBS News. I'll just stay down because of the cameras, sir. The price outlook, which of the three is most likely, $100 or the 50s or the 30s? The gut feeling one will get from your projections of high demand makes me think that for oil price, it's likely to be higher toward the 100. What's your view?
You know, our best judgment is that the reference case is the most likely outcome, but that it's not going to be a smooth path, as you know. We've had volatility both for geopolitical reasons as well as for even things like natural disasters or industrial accidents. So I'd say our best judgment is it's going to be in that $50 to $60 real when adjusted for inflation range, but that in any given year it could be significantly different than that. And if there are some things that have long-term implications, like changes in governments with large resources that decide to pursue a different policy, you could get significant. And we've looked at what if we're wrong about this resource assessment. I mean, you hear discussions about peak oil, and you hear other discussions that there may be, even significantly more resources. So we've tested the high and low cases against the significantly lower resource base that would get you the higher price, and significantly higher resource base would get you the lower price. And what the implications of either $39 on the low case and $100 on the high case. We do have a supply demand numbers that result from those in the full report, which will be released today.
Okay, can we go all the way to the back here on the left? Go ahead, sir.
Maybe a strange question, but is the war in Iraq having any kind of effect on the price, the skyrocketing record prices of gas here in the United States and around the world?
The main effect of on gasoline prices this year is largely in the downstream area. There's been significant amount of refineries offline, and the price of wholesale products has outpaced that of crude oil. So the actual crude oil component of the gasoline price so far this spring has not been the largest driver. So to that extent, Iraq or any other crude oil producer has had less of an effect than, let's say, would have been 2 years ago.
Thank you. Jonathan Elkind, Eastlink Consulting. Guy, in your slide 8, which shows world liquids consumption by region, it's a very striking difference between the growth in liquids demand for North America versus for OECD Europe. And I wonder if you could comment on some of the underlying assumptions. I take your point that it's, a January 1st, policies and measures in place before January 1st, but obviously this is a very, very different picture in the two mm-hmm. regions, and I'd be interested in what you see that resulting from.
Yeah, I'd say number one, John, the largest difference is a much fairly significant difference in the GDP assumption. So just total demand for energy growth in the U.S. is more than for OECD Europe. But in this particular case, obviously, the transportation sector is where all of those liquids are going. And then and the price for petroleum in used in the transportation sector is much higher in OECD Europe than it is here, and therefore the average vehicle is more efficient. People drive much less, so it's the classic response to in effect about a doubling of the price. Last time I looked, it was $6 and higher in most European countries per adjusted to the dollar and per gallon. So I think that's the main reason. Now, this does not include, as you mentioned, the proposed new policies, both by the president and those being debated in Congress now, which would increase the efficiency per new car sales. And that, of course, would change this picture. But based on existing policies and projected prices in real terms, we see continued growth in the U.S. and Canada in transportation fuels.
Okay. Can we swing back to the middle? Go ahead. Straight back. Thank you.
Thank you, Irv Chapman. I work for Bloomberg Radio. What unexpected developments would cause the price to drift down into the 30s, and what would be the impact on the oil producers if that were to happen? And could I also ask if carbon sequestration were to be taken seriously in designing new coal-fired plants, what would that do to CO2 projections?
Thank you. The largest single thing that could change the price outlook would be a slower rate of economic growth and other macroeconomic assumptions that we have in here. That if you got much lower economic growth than we're assuming in this outlook, that would slow down total energy demand. It would slow down economic activity, and that would then put, we would, all other things being equal, downward pressure on prices. Other possibility would be some technological change that would make some form of liquid fuel available at a much lower cost. I mean, you hear a lot of talk about biofuels that could be produced much more cheaply. We don't have that in our technological assumptions now, but with a 25-year time frame, you can't rule that out. Those are the main. And carbon capture sequestration, in this outlook, we go, as I mentioned, with existing technology, existing economics. Therefore, we have little or no carbon capture sequestration in this outlook. That could certainly be a counter to if we got carbon restrictions and we were able to develop carbon capture sequestration technologies at a reasonable cost, that would, again, be favorable for coal. So it would be a counterweight, if you will, to possible carbon constraints.
Let me go with Elizabeth on the side here, and then we'll swing back towards the middle.
Elizabeth Rosenberg with Argus Media. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more specifically about the natural gas picture in North America when you have the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline coming on, at what kind of volumes, and also what the strong non-OECD natural gas demand does for the forecast for LNG imports into the U.S.
Thanks. Thanks, Elizabeth. That's we certainly, in our outlook for North America, there's a couple things. One, we are expecting that there would be an Alaska pipeline on stream by 2018 in this outlook. And that would account for about 2 trillion cubic feet of new gas. The other main source of incremental gas for the U.S. is LNG. So we, and the reason why we are projecting U.S. imports of LNG to grow sharply is also related to North America, and that is our main supplier of foreign gas now is Canada. And what's happening in Canada is both a decline in their own domestic supplies available for export, and that we see steadily declining over the next 20 to 25 years, meaning that we'll need to replace the Canadian gas and any growth in imports with LNG. And we have LNG growing from about 6 billion cubic feet last year to 4.5 trillion cubic feet in 2030. Within Canada, we also are assuming the Mackenzie Valley, Delta Valley pipeline is built and on stream by about 2013. And that's very important. Now, if for some reason the Alaskan line is not built or the Mackenzie Valley line in Canada is not built, that would mean, A, we'd have higher gas prices than we are currently assuming, which is our current assumption for natural gas prices in the U.S. is range from $5 to $6 per 1,000 cubic feet in real terms during that same time frame as I showed for the oil. If either the Alaska gas is not available or the Mackenzie Valley and Canadian gas is not available, we think there'll be higher gas prices and we'll need more, even more LNG. And that's where the point you asked about what about all that growth in gas consumption in places like China, India, non-OECD Asia, that will put upward pressure on the price of LNG, since much of imported gas into Asia, including Japan and South Korea, it will be in the form of LNG. And if for some reason there's more demand than we're projecting, that means that probably that $5 to $6 price would be too low. If those things you if those possibilities were to happen.
Joe Kamelick with ISIS News. In your long-term outlook for natural gas availability price, have you given weight or consideration to the possibility of a natural gas cartel being formed? The exporting countries are looking into that now. Did that factor into your outlook at all?
I guess only to the extent that we thought about it, and our best judgment is it's highly unlikely that a gas cartel would be formed, or if it were to be effective. I mean, one of the things about gas is that most of the LNG projects are undertaken on the basis of long-term contracts. Sometimes, on average, probably about 90% of the output for an LNG project is contracted for on a long-term basis. So it seems like this really would not make much sense for an LNG supplier to start varying the supply to customers that it has entered into 20 and 30-year contracts with. So it's our judgment that it's unlikely to come about. Therefore, we looked at it and our judgment is that it would happen.
Bruce Averill from the State Department. You're showing a steady increase in consumption of liquids, slide previous to this one, and you're showing a steady increase in production of liquids. The units are different on the two. One's quadrillions of BTUs and one's a million barrels of oil equivalent. I assume that essentially you're production and consumption are keeping pace with one another. One of the major factors, though, that's going to be dictating strategic issues is the potential misbalance between demand and supply. So what about production capacity? How do you see that evolving? Is there going to be any significant or increase, decrease in production capacity, particularly for liquids such as petroleum, over the short to medium term, as in terms of your outlook?
Thanks. No, that's exactly right. I mean, what we're assuming is that the investments that are needed in those areas where the resources exist will be made to keep up with that demand, and that there will be enough of a cushion, you know, so-called spare productive capacity, to keep the market in balance. Now, as you know, doesn't always happen, and that's why you get these short-term perturbations. And indeed, it works both ways. I mean, in 2004, we used up almost all the spare productive capacity in the world, and prices have been rising steadily since then, and until the investment cycle can adjust to, I guess, put some downward pressure on price. And vice versa, in the 80s, spare productive capacity got over 10 million barrels a day, and OPEC couldn't keep the price from going below $10 a barrel. I mean, I don't necessarily think we're going to see that kind of swing again this time, but clearly it's in a industry that's have high front-end capital costs and long lead times, it's easy to get it wrong, as we've seen already in this decade, and how wrong on the other side OPEC got it in the 80s. So what, go back to the point I made, and that is that our long-term assumption of the price of oil is a nice, steady, straight line. We know it's not going to be a nice, steady, straight line. But the problem is you can't really predict those to that level of detail. But the trend is we don't think we're going back to the much lower prices, and we do think this represents a plausible assumption based on that outlook.
Question all the way in the backyard, right?
Hi there, Alan Zibel with AP. You have in your forecast that rising oil prices will dampen growth in demand for petroleum and other liquids after 2015. But did you have a price forecast for that 2015 time frame? You know, what level it would have to hit to cause growth to be dampened?
That's just based on the on the assumption that prices, once the investment cycle that we're in now, which is clearly insufficient, and we don't have enough spare productive capacity, we do see that changing, and you can see we do have the price going down to roughly $50 in 2012 or so. But then the rising demand does have an effect on price. We don't. There's not a specific price, if I'm getting your question correct, Alan, that dampens the demand there. It's the assumption that prices will rise steadily as a result of increasing economic growth and the availability of supply. But you know, certainly be happy to provide you with the specific details in the model.
Okay, other questions?
Larry Julin, Samuels International. What assumptions are you making with regard to hydrogen?
Okay, that's an easy one. We're assuming that hydrogen is not economic in this time frame in terms of hydrogen fuel cells, for example. We do not have any significant amount of demand for hydrogen before 2030 because of the current our assumptions of the cost of producing hydrogen in fuel cell vehicles. And again, that's another one that falls into the category of, that's based on existing, what we know about existing technology and what the existing costs are and projections as best we've been able to get them from those who are experts in that area.
Thank you. John McCormick with the Energy Policy Center. Is oil shale a part of the unconventional liquid supply?
Yes.
And to what degree?
And at the reference price case, the similar answer to hydrogen, the price is still too high, still too low. You don't get oil shale until you bring in the high price case, $100 in 2030. Then you do get some shale. And I, off the top of my head, I don't remember the amount, but it's it's several hundred thousand barrels a day, I believe, but the number is in there. But it does take that high a price in real terms to bring on shale.
Hossein Ibn Youssef, International Petroleum Enterprises. OPEC has lost about 10 million barrels of capacity since the late 70s. You're expecting about an additional 20 million barrels per day of capacity from OPEC. Where is it going to come from? One of the slides showed that about 15 million of the 20 comes from the Middle East. With the resource nationalism, the problems in the region, where is it going to come from?
Yeah, there is a detailed table in there, but I'll try to remember. The largest single increase is Saudi Arabia because of where the reserves are. And I believe that number is going from, say, 11 now to 16 round numbers in Saudi Arabia. But the other areas where, again, the resource base is there, whether the investments will be able to be made for both political stability reasons and other. Iraq certainly has potential to go much higher. And a little bit of increase in as well as in Kuwait, UAE, and I think a small increase in Iran. But the specific numbers by country are in the report. But the biggest increase will be Saudi Arabia. In this outlook in the Middle East.
We had actually just looked at that. 1979, OPEC's production capacity was 38 and change, and last year was a little over 30 million barrels a day. 75% of the loss came from Iran, Iraq, and Libya, either sanctions or war or political upheaval.
Yeah, the way, another thing is that what this depicts is production. And right there, that 23.5 OPEC conventional liquids in 2004, I believe, is the base year, has the Saudis at about 8.5, and the 2030 number has them at 16. So, in fact, the actual, in the way this is constructed by production, is actually a plus 8. It's the same. The answer is the same, but I just wanted to give you a more precise answer.
Herman Franzen, CSIS. Guy, how do you explain the relatively modest penetration of hybrids and diesel cars, particularly in North America? Other question is there a table somewhere that shows the supply in million barrels a day instead of quarts, which are very difficult for most people to read?
Second question is easier. Yeah, the actual tables in the back of the book, which show the individual, the answer to the previous question, are in barrels per day, millions of barrels per day. I think we have a pretty substantial market share growth for hybrids and flex fuel vehicles in this outlook for the U.S. We have it going up to, if I remember correctly, about 30% of new car sales in 2030, and it's less than 10% now. Now, you could say, maybe it should be more, and maybe it will be, but at least based on that price outlook and the assumptions in there. And again, there is legislation currently being debated on the in Congress now that would mandate even more efficiency. So again, if those policies change, we will change our assumptions about. But as of January 07, that's the our best judgment. And again, you also have to remember that at $50 to $60 real crude oil price, the implication for gasoline prices in the out years in real terms is $2.50, $2.60, something like that, per gallon. Which
okay, straight that all the way back.
Thank you. Néstor Iqueda, an Associated Press reporter for Latin America. I have a question on Venezuela. In the page 36 of your report, you mentioned Venezuela as one of the OPEC countries that have some geopolitical issues, making it difficult to calculate the production, the oil production levels. What is the a scenario you foresee for the energy sector in Venezuela for the next 20 years?
Well, how old is President Chavez? As you can tell from just this outlook that we have OPEC conventional liquids in South America pretty flat, even slight decline, and that's Venezuela, mainly Venezuela, and it reflects what we think is a rather problematic investment climate in the conventional crude oil outlook for Venezuela. We do have significant growth in heavy oils, so this does not reflect that. So it's not the total picture. So we do see heavy oil in the Orinoco region actually growing fairly significantly, but that the ability to attract foreign investment to go after the conventional liquids, we think will be not nearly as optimistic, let's say, for Venezuela's long-term production as it would have been, 5-6 years ago.
Nicely done. Please join me in thanking Guy Caruso, and thank you all for coming.